I'm Susie Larson. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Susie Larson Live. It's only just a matter of welcome to Susie Larson Live. Always honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, here we are. Tomorrow is Election Day. People are holding their breath, wondering how it's all going to shake out. Will it be a fair election? What will the repercussions be since this nation is so deeply divided? Christians on both sides of the aisle question the substance of their counterparts' faith. How can you call yourself a Christian and vote for X? And then there's respected Christian leaders who've opted out of voting, saying, you know what, I cannot in good conscience vote for either candidate. How did we get here? And, you know, this seems to be deeper and about something much greater than two flawed candidates. Has something shifted in the spiritual atmosphere? I actually think it has. I mean, are we under God's judgment? I'm not saying we are, but something has definitely shifted. So what? What are we to do? I mean, is the promise true that if we humble ourselves and seek God's face and turn from our wicked ways, that Jesus will hear us and heal our land? Of course it's true. Well, Stephen Mansfield joins me today. He's been on the show many times before, and I just told him before the show, what in the world was I thinking? He should have been on five times already this year. He should have been. But he always brings to me a sense of clarity and groundedness to the conversation. We're going to draw a little bit from his book that he wrote. It came out 4 years ago, but it's just as pertinent today. Ask the Question: Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. We've got five copies of this hardcover book. I said it released 4 years ago, just as pertinent today. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing, 877-933-2484. And I welcome your questions and comments throughout the show as well. Those need to come in a separate text. And just for the record, we're not here to tell you how to vote, but we do hope to initiate some very thoughtful conversation on one of the most important elections of our time. Quick announcement, two important quick announcements, if you will. We're giving a blessings bundle giveaway, a few of those, I think two a week actually, and it's a gratitude journal, a book on generosity, and some gratitude postcards. You sign up to win on our website, myfaithradio.com. Another quick announcement, save the date, November 15th, it's a Sunday night. We're doing a live stream event with Dr. Troy about the power of a grateful life, and we've got some amazing giveaways. So just mark your calendar, Sunday, November 15th, and more info to come in the days ahead. All right, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. Stephen Mansfield is a New York Times bestselling author of a number of books, including The Faith of George W. Bush, The Faith of Barack Obama, Lincoln's Battle with God, Choosing Donald Trump, God, Anger, Hope, and Why Christian Conservatives Supported Him, among other works of history and biography. He's the founder of the Mansfield Group. He's also an in-demand speaker and consultant. He makes his home in both Nashville, Tennessee, and Washington, D.C. with his wife, Beverly. And I love this guy. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you. You're very kind. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know this. We like to start every day talking scripture, wondering if there's a passage you've been pondering these days you can share with us.
Well, there is. I was reading the book of Habakkuk in the Old Testament, and Habakkuk 1:12 has the prophet Habakkuk addressing God as my holy one. And the reason that that touched me is the word holy is probably best translated as other. You know, Lord, you are other. You are completely different from us. You are the Lord who spoke the worlds into being and holds it together by the power of your word. And so the combination of the word my, which indicates relationship and closeness, and yet this very next word says other, amazing, out there, blowing our minds, really moved me. So he's mine in the sense that I have relationship with him, but he's also just so mind-blowingly other, we can barely get our minds around even the smallest truth about him. And I just love that Habakkuk was addressing. It's like saying my awesomeness, my unbelievably amazing one, you know, that kind of thing. And it really moved me at the time. I've used it in prayer quite a bit.
Wow, and beautiful. What a focus we need in such a time. And again, I wish I would have had you on numerous times this past year, and I'm sorry I didn't. I just should have. But tell me this. Give me your take on this past year and what you sense God is saying to us.
Well, I really do believe God is dealing with America. I'm hesitant to say he's judging America because of what that probably, you know, evokes in people's minds. They picture, you know, earthquakes and volcanoes and planes crashing to the ground, and I'm not sure we're there. But the Lord is definitely dealing with America, given the fact that most Christians, even if they vote, and they should, look at the two candidates and say, there's really not one I'm really wild about. I mean, I've talked to a lot of Christians, heard from a lot of Christian leaders, and they might vote for one candidate, but they got to hold their nose. And they might vote for the other candidate, they got to hold their nose even tighter. This is indication to me that the Lord is dealing with us as a nation. And I think when you put that together with the COVID season we are in and other things we read in the headlines, see in the headlines, I really think we are in a pre-revival state. I think God is dealing with us. I think he's shaking everything in the church that can be shaken, a process that's not completed yet. And I think it's an exciting time for those who are faithful to Jesus, but at the same time, I think it's a troubling time, obviously, especially for those of us who live here in D.C. and care about our country and watch what goes on close up. So that's the best overview I can probably give.
Wow, I really love the pre-revival state. I mean, revival happens. It doesn't happen in times of comfort and prosperity. It comes in troubled times. And boy, what a reminder for us. Well, in your book, Choosing Donald Trump, you ask this question: how did a crass, unrepentant reality TV star and cutthroat business tycoon secure the majority of the religious conservative vote? Now, this was 4 years ago where you asked this question in your book, but maybe answer that from 4 years ago. I know we're in a different time now, but how did that happen?
Well, of course, I believe what Scripture teaches, that you know, God sets one up, puts another down, and that elections are certainly important from a human perspective, but God is working in history, as we see him doing all through Scripture. But at a natural level, the reason that Trump was elected and had 81% of white evangelical support, et cetera, half of all Catholics, half of all churchgoers, is that, quite frankly, he championed, however stumblingly, however newfound his faith in these various policy positions were, he championed things that Christians held dear and which most Christians found that the Democrats dismissed. In fact, the word that I've heard used several times by Christians as I've talked to them about the Obama years, what they felt bombarded. They felt like their faith was bombarded, from LGBTQ issues to abortion, et cetera. We all know the tensions of that time. So when Donald Trump came along, he was crass. He once went to a church and put his money on the communion plate rather than in the offering plate. I mean, we can laugh at all those things. We can laugh at how he talked about the Bible. But the fact is, he was committed to championing some things that most Christians, certainly conservative Bible-believing Christians, maintain and are devoted to. So that's really what won the day. He won because he had strong evangelical and conservative Christian support. He mobilized others who might not have been so spiritually driven in their vote, but had laid back and seen Washington as literally as a swamp and as a place that was very distant from their values, their concerns, foreign trade, et cetera, strong defense, religious liberty. So that's what caused Donald Trump to become the front runner. And very few pollsters had it right. The Democrats didn't have it right. Hillary Clinton's team didn't have it right. I've talked to them. And that's why he's the surprising candidate he is. Now, those dynamics might change a bit in this election, but that certainly explains 2016.
Well, let's talk about where Christians land on these opposite sides of the aisle, because Christians who are voting for him right now say, if it was only one issue, I would vote for him because I'm voting for life because of the millions of babies who are barbarically slaughtered. I mean, you think about that, but also the fact that he's pro-Israel. He's done a lot for the black community, so many other things, what he's done for small businesses and so on and so forth. So they're saying, I can't really bear his personality. I'm not voting for a personality. I'm voting for these policies. Well, then Christians on the other side of the aisle saying, I cannot get past his personality. He's divisive. He's arrogant. He's ignorant. And with all the media, it becomes more, it sounds like activism than it does actual journalism. You honestly don't know if what you're believing or what you're hearing is actually true. So there's Christians on the left going, I really question your Christianity if you can vote for a man like that. So help us understand that, because there seriously are, as you know, sincere Christians on both sides of this argument going, I can't even believe you're considering to vote the way you are.
Yeah, it really comes down to what issues are most of concern to you. If abortion is almost your litmus test, then there's no question. There's only one candidate in this election. John Piper, as you, I'm sure you know, wrote a very powerful article in which he said, look, I'm pro-life, but I think there are other sins that Donald Trump commits, boastfulness and lying and what have you, that are equal to abortion in my frame and taint a nation just the same. So I'm not going to vote for him. I think he's decided not to vote for anyone or to write somebody in. Then, of course, you have Christians who are on the other side of the spectrum, and they say, well, what I really care about is social justice. What I really care about is Hispanic children being locked up in cages. What I really care about are some of these social justice issues and relief for people who are oppressed in other parts of the world, in which case they assume that Mr. Biden is the best choice. So this election is being defined, and this actually has a positive edge to it, more so than many elections, not so much by the personalities, because most people would not choose either one of these personalities, even if they vote for one of them. It's being defined by allegiance to certain policy positions, certain concerns in the world. And so, yeah, I live in D.C. I go to a largely African-American church. Many of them are voting for Donald Trump, again, as you say, because he's done such great things for the African-American community. Others have other concerns, and they are telling me, and by the way, when I walk through the parking lot, there's Biden, Trump's bumper stickers on cars, you know, almost in equal numbers, but they're voting for Biden because they have other policy concerns that are close to their hearts. I think that's going to be the defining issue, more so than personalities in this election.
I'm going to pause here, talking to Stephen Mansfield again. His book, Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. Great book, and there's some history lessons in the book as well. We've got 5 copies to give away. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. You got questions, comments, send those in a different text. And when we come back, we'll talk about that idea, that why it's important to ask some questions about their faith context. We shy away from that. We squirm at the thought of it, but it does matter. We should ask those questions. We'll talk more with Stephen Mansfield about that in just a moment. Thanks so much for tuning into Suzy Larson Live Talk and my friend Stephen Mansfield, New York Times bestselling author. And this book released 4 years ago, but I asked him to come back here today, the day prior to our election, just to give us some context, give us some perspective. His book is titled Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. As I said, there's some amazing history lessons in this book, so well researched. We've got 5 copies of this great hardcover book to give away. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. And I so welcome your questions, comments. Just send those in a separate text. Stephen, you write this, and again, you wrote this, you know, 5 years ago, probably, when I think about when the book came out. You said, what will be neither forgivable nor understandable is if our generation of Americans, with all the evidence amassed before us, continues to allow religion and American politics to be the sentimental, barely comprehensible, shadowy thing that it's been. Those in Munich who heard Adolf Hitler speak eventually wished they had asked more questions. We, too, must ask the questions of faith that need to be asked. It's time for the mysteries, the uncertainties, and the gambling with the nation's future to end. Wow. Say more.
Well, I think that religion does play a role in those people who run for office and who are sincere about their religion. The problem is that we, as the voters, allow ourselves in America to be, well, I don't want to use the word deceive, but we allow ourselves to be too quickly satisfied with simple answers. He's a Baptist. She's a Methodist. Well, what these people believe who are running for office, what these people believe once they get in office, will determine what the direction our country goes and will determine what happens in public policy. But let me ask you, I mean, what does the word Methodist mean these days? Does it mean a conservative, Bible-believing, you know, Christian who believes in a biblical worldview, et cetera? It can. At the same time, the word Methodist might mean someone who is extremely liberal in their theology, doesn't believe in the divinity of Jesus or the resurrection of Jesus, doesn't believe that the Bible is inspired, therefore wouldn't enact it or work to enact it in public policy in their work in government. So there are questions we have to ask. I'll take an example. I don't mean to offend. Kamala Harris is a quote-unquote Black Baptist. I would be willing to bet that the average American does not know what that means. Those of us who study religion do, but I would be willing to bet they don't. Then in a Senate hearing that had to do with a certain judicial nominee, she took the man's head off because he was Catholic and because he was a member of the Knights of Columbus. Again, something that most Americans probably don't know anything about unless they're Roman Catholic. And my response is, okay, this is a little confusing. What's going on here? She's a Christian, but she's hammering a Christian for being a Christian. Clearly, we need to ask some questions. We've many times in American history had somebody run for office, well, they're Baptist, well, they're a Methodist, well, they're this. But that's not enough. The titles don't mean anything anymore. The denominational names don't mean what they used to mean. We all know there's a difference between a conservative Catholic and a more liberal Catholic. We know there's a difference between a pro-life Catholic and a non-pro-life Catholic. So just saying they're Catholic and leaving it at that won't work. And there are many, many times in American history where the individual faith of a person in office has had massive difference, and yet the people voting for that person never asked the question in advance. Almost our entire policy towards Israel, for example, or towards abortion, or towards LGBTQ, or towards racial reconciliation, these are deeply faith-oriented issues. And if we don't ask the question in advance, then we're electing people whose behavior in office we're not going to be able to anticipate, therefore we're not going to be able to make a wise vote.
I think I saw a quote in your book, I'm probably going to get it wrong, but Gandhi said, if you don't think religion impacts or should impact politics, you don't understand religion. We shy away, we squirm, we apologize, and yet it does inform. And you know, everybody has faith in something, and it informs our choices and our perspective, doesn't it?
No, there's no question about it. I mean, essentially, a law is the codification of a value system. When somebody makes a law, they're codifying, they're putting into a system certain values. Well, those values come largely from religious perspectives. They're not scientific. Why don't we have laws that say you have to wear a blue shirt on Tuesday? Because there's nothing moral about it. There's nothing higher principle about it. It's just a silly, dictatorial kind of law. But we do have laws that say the pedestrians, come first on our roads. Why? Because we believe a certain version of life. We believe a certain version of protecting human life, etc. So all laws are the codification of higher principles, truth, religion. And therefore, since we're sending people to Washington, D.C. to enact our laws and to execute them, we need to ask the kinds of questions that go into the making of the law. Otherwise, we get people in office that just shock us with how they're the reverse of what they seem to be in the campaign. And I think this is a big issue even in this election. Many people are orienting to their vote based on religious principles, but do they really know what their candidate believes? And I think this is why we've got to really keep this question before, and keep this insistence before the voters. Ask the question. Ask your elected leaders to draw a line from their faith to certain policy positions so that we can understand who they're going to be when they get in office.
Yeah, you know, I would love to hear that. You say you're a Baptist or you say you're a Catholic or whatever, and you're running for office, and yet you voted down, you know, the act. There was one that it's at 20 months, I think they discerned that that's when a baby feels pain. And there was some law that made it to the floor about at least anesthetize the child if you're going to take the child's life. And it was voted down. It's like, I want to know. So you say you're a Baptist, but you voted that down. How does that reconcile? I would love for someone to ask that, but it seems like we do shy away from some of those more difficult questions.
We do, because they feel uncomfortable. You know, in American history, yeah, as you know, we've got this sense that we're not supposed to have quote-unquote religious tests. That language comes from our constitutional authors, comes down from the founding fathers, but it had to do with appointment to federal jobs. It had to do with appointment to government positions. Our founding fathers fully understood that the people were going to consider religious issues when they considered a candidate. They talked about that openly. They even, frankly, talked about one day we may see Muslims elected. One day we may see atheists elected. They knew that people would make decisions in time. But the only thing forbidden was that you could have a religious test for somebody going into public office. So the people should evaluate religions. The current candidates, I'm not going to get into detail so we can keep the discussion broad and philosophical, but the current candidates have got various views of religions. Some of them have reversed themselves pretty dramatically on religious issues within the first few days of announcing their candidacy. Others of them are maybe young and new about their faith, but they're trying to enact a certain religious worldview. I want to know what that is before they go in there. I have certain beliefs. I know where I stand. I know who I am politically. How do I know who I align with if they say, hey, religion and a faith in God is going to guide my hand? But then we don't have any idea what that actually means. And so we tend to let people off the hook with God bless America and maybe having a clergyman read at the beginning of or pray at the beginning of one of their events. But we need to have forums where we can literally not beat on them, not religiously persecute, but ask for an understanding of what they're going to be doing in office in terms of how they're influenced by religion. It's a very, very important area, and it shaped our country in the past.
It'd be really amazing to see more town halls where someone's given a voice and given platform to ask that question and even a follow-up question. Well, Brian Texan says, what are your thoughts on the lining up of moral and biblical pluses and minuses of each candidate and then deciding to vote based on which candidate holds the edge?
Well, I certainly think that's the way a lot of Christians should think. We should think in terms of what are the issues that are biblical, what are the issues that we care about as Christians, and where do the candidates align. Just make sure you're not being lied to. Just make sure. Don't just look at a checklist based on answers to recent questions and political events. Look at the person's conduct. Look at who they've been down through the years. You mentioned partial birth abortion. Well, when Barack Obama was running for office, he seemed to indicate that he would be moderate on abortion. But those of us who knew about him earlier in his political career knew that he had actually voted against a partial birth abortion ban in Illinois. So this means the child, I'm not going to be too graphic here, is partially born and then, put to death outside of the womb. Well, that in any other context is murder. So my point is not to hammer Mr. Obama. My point is to say, You would have been deceived, I think. You would have been, led astray had you just listened to political pronouncements, let's say in the last 3 months of the election. But if you delved a little further in and learned a little bit more about who this person was when they held office in Illinois in this case, then you would have had the truth. So I'm all for checklists. I just think that sometimes they're based on recent political pronouncements, and therefore they can be a little thin and not tell the true story.
Wow. Stephen, on the other side, let's talk about spiritual discernment, but also, as you say, looking at track record, not what they say. But here's the two obstacles. You know, one I mentioned, kind of the media activism, not journalism, it seems, anymore. And the idea where people really don't want to be governed by church, by law enforcement, by anybody. And it's your truth and it's my truth. So you can basically look at a candidate going, okay, that corruption might have happened, but I really don't care because this is my truth and this is what I want. How do we navigate those waters of people really honestly at times not wanting to know facts or, truth? And then we're getting all this input. How do we discern what's actually true? That's sort of a boggled way of asking you a question that I know you can answer. Talking to Stephen Mansfield, his book is titled Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. We've got 5 copies. It's just a brilliant book, so well researched. Love to get you in on a drawing. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute.
So you can run right at your mountain like it's already moved. And you can chase down your Goliath like you know he's gonna lose.
Thanks for tuning in to Susie Larson Live. Just a quick reminder, if you are in Christ, you're part of a heavenly kingdom, and we have a king, and we can trust him as we walk through, navigate these very trying times. Thanks for tuning in. I'm talking to Stephen Mansfield. He's a New York Times bestselling author, consultant, leadership, leader of leaders. His book really released 4 years ago, but I asked him to come on today just because we're a day prior to the election. Ask the question, why we must demand religious clarity from our presidential candidates. And he does some great history lessons for us here in this book as well. It's so well researched. We've got 5 copies to give away. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. Melissa texted in and said, I heard this today from a political analyst. When it's about personality, the Democrat wins. When it's about issues, the Republican wins. You know, there's something to be said about that. And again, I'm not dumping on Barack Obama either, but he was an incredible orator. He was charming and smooth. And yet he's the one who put the big rainbow on the White House. And then you've got our current president who's fighting so much for so many biblical values, but says the most divisive things. It's just so hard to get your head around. I mean, what do you say about that?
Well, I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. right now, and one of the things we often say is Democrats throw better parties, which is kind of humorous and meant to be fun. But the point is that, Democrats who tend to be a bit better at the PR game are often better personalities, more fun, rowdier. Who can't like Barack Obama the other day? I don't know if you saw the video. He's leaving a campaign event. He grabs a basketball and sinks a three-pointer from the corner of a basketball court and then makes some laughing statement and walks off. I mean, I often, because I advise Republicans often, I'm often saying to them, why can't we be like that? Why do we have to be the other way? But the reason is that Republicans tend to come from the private sector. They tend to come from business. They tend to be less professionals in what they are doing politically, whereas Democrats tend to work in government for years. Look at Joe Biden, 47 years in Washington, D.C. He's learned how to smile. He's learned how to move. He's learned how to comb his hair, take care of his teeth, and all the things you do when you're constantly on camera and constantly have to run for office. So all of that to say, it is a bit of a personality game, and Donald Trump, for example, incites those, gets those excited about him who like his kind of hard-hitting, brash, crass, even personality. But for the most part, he can be very much a turnoff while he's doing noble things. And again, he comes from the business sector. He's not great at PR, stumbles over himself all the time. Joe Biden, far slicker. Far wiser, far more controlled, tightly managed organization, very good rollout of his campaign, et cetera, et cetera. I don't mean I'm with him. I'm just saying their professionalism is very clear. And that's something I personally believe that American voters need to wake up to. Are we really electing an entertainer, or are we electing somebody who's going to professionally and skillfully execute our values in office? And that can be two different kinds of people, two different kinds of personalities. Let's not be fobbed off by the entertainer personality and the person who's more charming on the stage.
Wow. This listener says, it says that we will give an account of our lives, Matthew 12:36, Romans 14:12. It says we'll give an account of our lives. Do you think that people that don't vote in this election to save unborn children should be concerned at the end of their lives with these verses, with giving an account for how they voted? What do you say?
I think that voting is an extension of our life, and I think that we will it is part of something that we are accountable for to God. I'm careful about saying that those who don't vote are accountable for the unborn. I'm as strongly the pro-life as you can be, and done many events to help raise millions of dollars. I was almost aborted myself. Another story for another interview. Mm-hmm. But all that to say that I'm strongly pro-life, but I understand there are many pro-life people who just can't bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump for other reasons. They recognize that he's pro-life, but for other reasons. I mean, even Billy Graham's granddaughter, as we all probably know, is now famously saying she's going to vote for Biden. She's actually part of an organization called Pro-Lifers for Biden. Now, I can't get my mind around that, but I'm not going to consign her to hell or say she's going to come under the judgment of God. So this is the troubling nature of this current election season. You have people making choices that you don't agree with. You have candidates that you can't fully embrace. So some people are trying to, you know, vote for part of candidate A and part of candidate B. It doesn't work that way, but I certainly understand their struggle. And I know many people are coming down on both sides of this election who are good and godly people and believe what they're doing is spirit-led. And we're just going to have to allow some freedom in this matter.
And, you know, and the truth is that conviction is, you know, we'll face God alone. Nobody's going to stand with me. I can't point and blame anybody. I know I'm going to stand before God. And so I have to do the very things that he's bringing conviction to me to do. And that's just going to be true for each and every one of us. We'll stand before God. And wow, it is a sobering time. But let's talk about this. One of our listeners wrote in earlier and said, is it okay to make checklists? I think that was Brian. And you'd said, as long as the checklists are based on truth, because sometimes you can be lied to. And a candidate can say, this is what I'm about and this is what I care about, but a voting record would show otherwise. When you add in media censorship and media bias, Stephen, and then you add in a people who really want to hear what their tickling ears want to hear, as Scripture says, what are we supposed to do with all that? And as Christians, how do you sort it out? How do you discern what's true?
Well, if you're going to be politically active in this generation, especially in the United States with our strong media, as you're saying, we're going to have to drill down beyond just the presentation. I know people, for example, I'm going to pick on Hillary Clinton here for just a moment. I know people who voted for Hillary Clinton because she was a Methodist and they were Methodists. They assumed that that meant a certain thing. But when they asked me after they had voted, I said, well, let's just do an intellectual exercise here. And I shared with them some of the quotes that are in the book in my chapter on Hillary Clinton. Well, I'm not going to hate Hillary Clinton. I pray for her. I'm not trying to bombard her, but I could never vote for her. So I shared some of these quotes with them. And they were shocked. They were utterly shocked. Why? Because they had bought the language of the campaign largely in its last 3 to 4 months, and they did not know the broader life. They did not know earlier speeches. They had not had access or did not have exposure to things she had said about, hey, if we're going to have abortion rights in this country, then longstanding religious convictions are just going to have to be banished. I mean, she used a different word, but basically she's saying they're going to have to be dealt with. They're going to have to be expunged. Well, that shocks this person. She couldn't believe a Methodist would say it. And here's an example of what I'm talking about. The titles of people's denominations, the labels that we use, don't work anymore. Most people are smorgasbord when it comes to their religion. They're at a religious buffet, one from column A, two from column B. Reminds me of a time I was in Iraq talking to soldiers about faith for my book, Faith of the American Soldier. And I asked a guy what he believed. He said, about two-part Sunday school, one-part Deepak Chopra, a few fortune cookies, and a little bit of Billy Graham. Well, that is really the kind of faith that many people have these days. It's a just piece it together, pastiche kind of thing. So with that kind of faith, you can't just use the labels. The word Methodist, and I'm not picking on Methodists, I come from that background, but the word Methodist doesn't mean anything anymore. That's why the denomination is splitting. So you have to go beyond just the labels and beyond just the campaign rhetoric.
What advice do you have? Let's say it goes with Biden, and you've got a lot of the media, not willing to even ask him any difficult questions, and then you've got censorship with these big tech companies. What hope is there? I mean, how should Christians navigate that if it becomes where, you know, faith is vehemently opposed, and the goal is to expunge faith, and that it wouldn't inform what we do? How do we? I mean, I know other places in the world thrive under persecution, but what might it look like in America, and how would we navigate that?
Yeah, I think if we have a tyranny going on in America today, it's the tyranny of the mind. It's a tyranny over the mind. It is a result of our American people, for the most part, preferring education, preferring easy answers, not being, I just say intellectual or giving sophisticated thought to what they're dealing with politically. I think you're absolutely right. Joe Biden is one of the least vetted candidates in this election. Now, he's been vetted throughout his 47 years. One of the least vetted, one of the least investigated candidates in this election. He's basically, as I'm sure you've heard people joke, stayed in his basement until recently. He's had no tough interviews. He's had no rigorous grillings from media from both sides. The debates, as we all know, were of mixed value. And so this man is running for office without us being able to, quote unquote, ask the question. And that's a huge problem. We should be insisting upon more. We should be demanding more. And so I think that this is going to be part of the issue going forward. If the American people are going to set themselves up to be deceived, are going to set themselves up with campaign rhetoric being the full framing of a given candidate, they're going to get very bad candidates. They're going to get unqualified people. And when you add that to the very contentious politics we have today, we're going to have very, very bad government. So it's a matter. It's up to the people, and that's what the founding fathers believed. The people will have to rescue the system, so to speak, and will have to ask the tough questions, and will have to dive into the facts. We all know that the media has a very strong slant, that very little wisdom and light comes from that, so we're going to have to go beyond the surface. And most Americans, frankly, just aren't willing to do that.
Wow, have mercy, oh God, really. You know, another thing, you work with young people often, and I've heard this from a number of millennials. One thing, one of the reasons they're abandoning the faith and they're crossing over the aisle, so to speak, is they cannot stand the idea that we have allowed our politics to intertwine so deeply with our faith in that, you know, you can only be Christian and be in the Republican Party, and we don't question things. I've heard that over and over again from millennials saying, it's hard for me to respect that. It's just hook, line, and sinker, and you don't question things. So maybe speak to that, if you would.
Yeah, we don't tend to question things, and so we tend to be single issue. So, for example, the average millennial, maybe he or she goes to an evangelical church, they hear the pastor supporting a certain candidate or a certain government or a certain party because they're pro-life or because they support religious liberty, but then they see videos of children being in cages along the border. They see videos of people being mistreated. They see lying, perhaps, by the candidate or whatever it is, and they go, look, if we're talking about the character of Jesus, and this is not my argument, obviously. This is their argument. You know, the word abortion is not even used in the Bible, but compassion for the poor is. Compassion for the stranger is. Compassion for the immigrant, so to speak. That's one way you can translate some Hebrew words, is. So I'd much rather lean towards a candidate who's on the clear side of Scripture rather than on the obscure. And between that and the kind of political tensions that we have, even around Thanksgiving tables, you're right. We're losing the young to the church. We didn't teach them a biblical worldview. We didn't teach them how to reason biblically. We didn't teach them perhaps the other side, the social justice side of the faith. We just taught them the moral absolute side of the faith, and many of them are rebelling against that now. And especially when if they show up in church, and I don't mean this negatively, but it is negative to them, if Donald Trump is preached in the sermon. And they can't get their minds around Donald Trump being a godly man. So this is we do have a massive movement of youth out of conservative churches, and it's largely because of the issues I've just described.
Wow. And I think I have this right. I think the pictures of children in cages actually was taken during the Obama-Biden administration. And once some of the tweets that tweeted that realized that, they didn't retract. They just deleted the tweet. But that, again, is just such a picture of where we're at right now. You know?
Yes, it is, and not to debate with you because I obviously agree with where you are. I have pretty good knowledge. It was down there actually. The pictures were taken under both. But the question is, when did the policy start? And the fact is that the President Trump got tarred with a brush that was actually created long before he came into office. So yeah, it's been our policy for a while, but his administration didn't manage the public presentation very well, which is again part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And one last thought just about that before we go to break. But my understanding, too, is at times when children are separated from the people who brought them over, sometimes they're being trafficked. So they're not coming across the border with their families. And so they're not going to be reunited with the people that were trafficking them. Is that right?
No, that's absolutely right. I'm the chairman of the board of an organization called Uncaged, and we track this and work with in trafficking, and that is a lot of the reason children are brought to the border. Some are families just looking for help, as we all know, but yes, you're absolutely right. Trafficking is huge behind this, and that's another thing that we should have been talking about. We should have been talking about the trafficking that undergirds a lot of this illegal immigration, but that just never became part of the public debate.
Lord in heaven, have mercy. When we come back, I want to refer to a story you tell about Dr. Benjamin Franklin. It was a time in our country's history when it seemed on the brink of civil war, and he gives a speech about the need to call on God to help them make their decisions. I want you to just, I'll read that portion of that speech and have you speak to it, Stephen. Having a great conversation with Stephen Mansfield. I always appreciate our conversations. He's a New York Times bestselling author. You have to check out his books. His podcast is excellent. This book was released 4 years ago, but it's just as timely today. Ask the question, why we must demand religious clarity from our presidential candidates. You got questions, comments, you can text those in. If you want in on the drawing, in a separate text, text the word book to 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. Tuning in to Suzy Larson Live, talking to New York Times bestselling author Stephen Mansfield. He consults politicians. He leads leaders. He's got an amazing podcast. And again, he's a New York Times bestselling author. This book released 4 years ago, but I asked him to come on the day before the election because it just was time for an important conversation around the election. His book is titled Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. So well researched. We've got five copies of this important book to give away. Text the word book to 877-933-2484. So here we are. You reference this story in your book where we're on the brink of a civil war, and Ben Franklin talks about God's intervention in a recent war and on behalf of the nation. And here's a portion of that speech. To that kind of providence, we owe this happy opportunity of consulting in peace on the means of establishing our future national felicity. And have we now forgotten that powerful friend? Or do we imagine we no longer need his assistance? I have lived, sir, a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, is it probable that an empire can rise without his aid? Wow. Say more about, give us maybe even more context around that.
Well, it was 1787. It was during the Constitutional Convention, Philadelphia. And there was great contention. Alexander Hamilton had already left in a huff, angry. There was a lot of division. The states were having a hard time hammering out a workable governing system and were in contention over a number of issues. Jefferson was writing letters from Paris urging rebellion. I mean, it was really an ugly situation. And of all people, Benjamin Franklin, who was not known to be that religious of a figure, stood up and asked permission to speak. General Washington nodded. And he then gave the speech that includes the words you just gave. Now, what's interesting is he was proposing a prayer, and the delegates actually said, no, we're not going to have a prayer. But, and that was because of some issues about religion and politics and what the views were at the time. But what's interesting is that Benjamin Franklin's speech did change the tone of the convention. It did move things forward. It did convict hearts, even though there was a vote against having the prayer that he was proposing. The fact is that him standing up, reminding people of God's providence during the Revolution, reminding them of his hand in empires and his governance in the world, caused their thoughts to turn to him. And it, like I say, it changed the tone of the convention, and things moved forward more swimmingly. And that was a massive turning point in the history of our country, coming from a surprising source. And I have to tell you quickly that this encourages me because, you know, a lot of what we are called to do as Christians today may not get the vote, may not get the political support, but it still can change the tone. It still can change the spirit. It still can call from hearts a vision of God that changes their conduct long term. So I've always looked at that moment with Franklin as a big example for me. Don't just do what's going to get political support. Do what changes the culture. Do what changes the tone and see what comes of it.
Wow, that's a powerful perspective. I mean, you could look at that story and look at it as a fail, but it did change the tone. And, you know, you mentioned in the book that these men had just fought this war of independence from an empire in which the church and state were so one, but it did not serve the people well. I wonder, were they hypersensitive to being controlled by religion? And do you think that's part of the pushback?
Yes, that's part of what you have to bear in mind when we're dealing with First Amendment issues and how they wrote, you know, about religion at the time. They were very, very suspicious of any connection between church and state. They had just rebelled against England. They had been oppressed by the church as well as the state, basically in England, of course, especially at that time. The king was the head of the church. So when the king sent troops, he was sending clergy right along with them, and the whole thing was oppressed. Colonial churches were burned to the ground. Colonial Bibles were burned. Colonial pastors were put to death. And so, yeah, it was a religious war as much as anything else. So they had come out of that. They were embittered. They had won. They didn't want any semblance of a religious state. And so they objected to things like even that light petition by Benjamin Franklin at that moment. But again, apart from that, still Benjamin Franklin, I think, rescued the convention by fixing everyone's eyes on God, regardless of whether the prayer actually occurred. And that's, a massive turning point in the spiritual and the political history of our country.
Well, you're such a historian, Stephen. I wonder, given what you know about our forefathers, our founding fathers, if they were to step into today, what would grieve their hearts the most? And maybe is there anything that would please them, you think?
I think there are things that would please them. I think there are they would love to see just physically Washington, D.C., and the way their words, their images are remembered, and the love for them in many hearts. But I think they would mainly be concerned about the apathy. They wouldn't be that surprised by changes in government. If you read their writings, they said, yeah, generations from now, things will be different, and you'll have different people running for office, and people will think differently. They expected change. That's why they put an amendment process into the Constitution and what have you. But I think it would be the apathy. I think it would be these are men who suffered and died. Some of the men who signed our Declaration, you know, lost family members, had wives murdered. I mean, I could go on and on and on with their sacrifices. So it reminds me of John Adams saying at one point when he was asked, "What kind of a government have you given us?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." And that's I think the attitude with which they would look on this generation. Are we keeping it? Are we diligent? Do we recognize the sacrifices of previous generations? And are we paying attention and being dutiful patriots in our political behavior? I think the average American has to say no. We find Washington to be irritating. We distance ourselves from the process. We vote without knowledge. And I think they would find that the most disturbing thing of all.
Boy, it is time for a great awakening, Stephen. When you think, if you just step back from 2020, we still are an amazing nation. We are so wealthy. It's the land of the free and the home of the brave. There's much wrong, and there's much we need to repent of, absolutely. But there's so much right here. There's many reasons to rejoice and to be happy and to be grateful. And if only we could approach, you know, our problems with civility and honor the system of checks and balances, because that's really great, great wisdom. Maybe if you had the whole nation just listening today, how would you charge every American listening today?
I would try to encourage them to understand that we have something very precious in this nation. I've lived abroad. Many of them have lived abroad. We look at the news from other nations. We have something unbelievably precious, something that's been handed down by our forefathers, something that hundreds of thousands have died to protect, and we've been given a sacred trust. And so I would say dial down the anger, dial down the promised violence and threats and all of that. Let's realize the precious nature of what we've had, what we have. Certainly we've made mistakes. Certainly we have things going wrongly to some degree in this generation. But it can be fixed. And we need to rev up our sense of patriotism and our sense of civic righteousness. I mean that, yes, it's a religious statement, but civic righteousness is the idea that we're going to do the right thing in our society to bring healing and wholeness and to build a society that serves all well. And I would try to call them back to an understanding of the value of the country, the preciousness of the country, and their duty in it. And I think that that's what a lot of people are trying to do today, and I applaud them.
I think I'm going to write you in on the ballot. I'm just kidding.
Very kind.
But you're absolutely so right. And as you hear, you were talking to every American, and then as we speak to every Christian, you know, I got to tell you, I've been on my knees. I've wept over this, but the division and the vitriol between Christians, I want to say we've lost our minds. This has got to stop. We've got to be able to walk in humility, be powerful in prayer, take a stand, love not our lives even unto death. But the angst and the angry, the accusation, it grieves me beyond words. What about you?
Well, God, I believe, yes, it grieves me tremendously, and I live in the middle of a lot of it here in D.C. But I'll tell you, God is shaking everything that can be shaken. His judgment's
right.
beginning at the church. I take a lot of this discord and a lot of this wrangling, even in our pews, again, as a judgment of God, as something he's dealing with, as something he's calling us to righteousness. And it's interesting to me, and I don't mean to be speak of it lightly, because some of these people are my friends, that some of the pastors who have left the pastorate, and we know that pastoral suicide is quite high, and et cetera. All of this is part of God reaching to the church, dealing with the church, trying to call us to humility. It does not take, you know, history is not governed by the majority. It's governed by the dedicated minority, and I would say the godly minority. And so if we will recover ourselves, if we will realize that God is dealing with the church, and once he does that, he has the channel through which to heal the nation, then I think we'll probably cooperate with his processes and fall on our faces and start humbling ourselves and confessing our sins and seeing him do something mighty.
Yeah. One person willing to draw a circle around them and say, humble me, revive me, help me to be a light in this world could change the world, literally. Stephen, I'm not going to let so much time pass next time you join us. I'm always so equipped and encouraged when I get to talk to you. Thank you for your presence in the kingdom and in our nation. We appreciate you so much.
Oh, it's my privilege. Thank you so much. God bless you.
Yeah, until next time. Stephen Mansfield, everyone, and his book is titled Ask the Question, Why We Must Demand Religious Clarity from Our Presidential Candidates. But friends, let's just be on our knees. Let's humble ourselves. You know, may Lord revival start with me. What if we did that? It would make a difference. It absolutely would. Let's be praying through these next days, standing in faith, not in dread, not in fear, but in faith, and use our God-given authority to tear down the strongholds that seek to destroy. God is with us, and he will not fail us. We'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Suzy Larson Live. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link to spread the good news of the gospel and to grow the impact of the show. Also, if you would, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player, and never miss a show.